From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
And welcome to The Doctor Is In for another scintillating podcast with the Doctor, Joel Hallis.
Well, it's great to be here again, Steve, and I'm happy to answer questions or talk about anything you like.
Questions by the dozens, but actually, well, I have a question.
Okay.
I have a question, really. Let's talk about ladder line. Here's my question. Now, ladder line has been around for, really, as I understand it, since practically the dawn of amateur radio. Is that correct?
I think that's true. The very early antennas were at much lower frequencies and tended to be directly fed, you know, 500 kilohertz or whatever people used to operate on. There essentially were no transmission lines at that point. And this sort of went after the model of the shipboard radio station, which was up on the top deck, and the antenna wire came right into the station and the ground wire went out the bottom to the hull.
Mm-hmm.
But the next step was antennas that were fed with what we now call open wire line, which some people refer to as ladder line. That certainly was in play, I would say, certainly by the 20s and maybe before. The typical antenna was a center-fed dipole arrangement for the higher frequency bands, fed with open wire line, separated by often wooden insulators soaked in paraffin was the early equivalent of porcelain.
That would burst into flame if enough power was applied to it, right?
I hadn't heard about that, but of course that could be a good tuning indicator. I mean, if it's not burning, you aren't putting out enough power.
Well, now, maybe we ought to define our terms here, because so many hams, and I'm one of them, tend to misuse the term ladder line, because we know they're different, truly different kinds of open wire line.
That's absolutely true, and I actually avoid that term, because so many people picture a different thing with it. If you look at open wire line, it actually looks like a ladder.
Mm-hmm.
It has vertical elements, conductors on either side, and it has horizontal, what could be steps of a ladder going up it. So a lot of people refer to open wire line as ladder line, but other people refer to window line as ladder line. So what I've done in my writing and tried to be consistent is to strictly use the term open wire line for the kind with just typically rod insulators of some sort versus the window line, which is essentially twin lead with windows cut in it every so
mm-hmm.
often. While they're similar in many ways, they are somewhat different in terms of their operation. And it's good to be clear what you're talking about. So that's what I usually use the term window line or open wire line, either of which some people refer to as ladder line.
Now, most amateurs are using, as far as I can tell, the 450-ohm windowed ladder line. Or, excuse me, the windowed... Give me the proper term, Joel.
Well, I don't know if it's proper. The one I use to avoid confusion is window line.
Window line. Okay. And what would you say would be the primary advantage of windowed line?
Well, the primary advantage of window line compared to coaxial cable, which is probably the most popular transmission
mm-hmm.
line used. There are a number of them, actually. The biggest advantage is that it has lower loss, all things being equal, than coax. So more of your power that you put into the bottom of the transmission line gets to the antenna, assuming everything is done properly, with window line or open wire line than does with coax. And how much of a difference it makes depends on the type of coax you're comparing it to and whether or not it's matched and so forth. Just as an example, I have some numbers in front of me.
You have paper.
I have
okay.
paper. I'm rattling my paper here, as you can tell, just so you know it's real paper. As an example, the typical coax at 100 feet of coax matched to a 50-ohm load, if it's RG8X, which is very popular, it has an attenuation of 1.9 decibels per 100 feet. RG213, which is the thicker coax sort of RG8 size, 1.1 dB per 100 feet. Now, 1 dB is about 20% power loss. So if you have 100 feet of RG8X on 10 meters, and you put 100 watts in the bottom, the antenna will see 80 watts. assuming everything else is working in between.
Mm-hmm.
So the RG8X will lose twice that much, or let's say 2 dB. If we look at window line, there are a couple different types, and the attenuation depends on the wire size. So the thinner 551 that's on the TLW software has an attenuation of 0.36 decibels per 100 feet, as compared to almost 2 decibels for RG8X.
Wow, that's significant.
It is. And the 554, which has thicker conductors, is only 0.26 dB per 100 feet. So 0.3 decibels, which is about what most window line is, if matched, loses about 7% of your power. So in that case, you'd have 93 watts getting to the antenna. So that's a big difference. But it's even more important if you have a mismatch, because the attenuation due to the mismatch depends on the attenuation when it's matched. So it's much worse. I haven't run numbers on that, but it can be very significant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you can use a window line in what's called a center-fed ZEP or some kind of an antenna that's not matched, and use a tuner at the bottom of the feed line and operate it on multiple bands. You can't really do that successfully with coax.
Because the loss is too high.
The loss will go up very dramatically. So that's one big advantage. That's probably the primary advantage, is that window line has less loss. But by the way, open wire line has even less loss. 10 meters, 100 feet of open wire line, typically 0.1 decibels of loss.
Wow.
That's about 2%. So 98% of your 100 watts will get to the antenna, as compared to 80 watts with RG213, as an example. So loss is the big thing there.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing is, interestingly enough, I mean, a lot of times when you get higher performance, you have to pay more.
Yes.
Window line actually costs less than most coax. It's not a dramatic difference in this kind of an overlapping region, but good coax costs a lot more than good window line. And even cheap coax is more expensive than cheap window line. So it's, you know, they cover the same kind of range, but there's a slight advantage to window line. A more subtle advantage is that window line is lighter than coax, by
yes.
and large.
Yes.
And what that translates into is less sag if you have the antenna holding up the transmission line, instead of the feed point being pulled downward and mm-hmm. adding stress to the whole antenna system, it's less stress and less tension on the antenna. So that's a third advantage. So the only disadvantages of either window line or open wire line, by the way, open wire line is in about the same price range as coax as well.
Uh-huh.
The disadvantage is that our radios tend to be designed to operate into a 50-ohm system.
Yes.
And, of course, window line isn't. So what you have to do is do some kind of a transformation. And it also can require a transformation at the antenna, depending on the antenna design and how you plan to use it. But typically you need something like an antenna tuner or a balanced to unbalanced transformer and impedance transformer to have the antenna system impedance show up as 50 ohms for the radio. Now, by itself, that's not necessarily terrible, and sometimes with a tuner gives you a lot of flexibility for adjustment and so forth. But, of course, you do have loss in the tuner, and you have to be careful when you think about loss, that if your antenna tuner has half a dB of loss,
mm-hmm.
well, a lot of your advantage for the window line has disappeared. So
yes.
It's not dramatic in the matched case. It is very dramatic in the case of a mismatched antenna where you're trying to use it on a different band. Then the only viable operation or option is window line or open wire line, in my opinion.
Now, you mentioned the ZEP, or let's just say a dipole.
Okay.
And give it the length of 66 feet. Let's make it a half wave on 40 meters.
All right.
Now, you're feeding it in the center with the windowed line, the 450-ohm windowed line. What you often hear is that, well, all you have to do is have an antenna tuner with a balanced output, and you can load that antenna on virtually any band, or at least, you know, 40 meters and up and so on. Is that true necessarily? I mean, you mentioned the loss in the tuner, so does it really depend on the tuner?
The key factor here is what the impedance ends up being at the bottom of the transmission line. That's the impedance the tuner has to deal with. And you can have some lengths of line and lengths of antenna that result in a very high or very low impedance at the bottom of the antenna feed line. And sometimes the tuner can't handle that. The typical wide-range antenna tuner is spec'd to be able to work up to about a 10-to-1 SWR.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have the wrong lengths, you can sometimes get a much higher SWR at the bottom and the tuner can't deal with it. Or if it can, it can be damaged in the process. I've done that because even though you can match to it, if the tuner's spec'd at 10 to 1 and you drive a 50 to 1 antenna, even if you can force the tuner to tune, the currents and voltages in the tuner can be much higher than it's designed for. And I've actually melted switch contacts in my tuner.
Is that how you get the melted little 4-to-1 balans that are in some of the antenna tuners?
Well, you can do that too, yeah. Yes. Balance, ferrite has a lot of good characteristics, but one of the characteristics that is not too good is that it does not dissipate heat well. Hmm. So you put heat into it, and it can't get out, and eventually it'll get hotter and hotter and finally crack. Yeah. And that happens.
Yes, yes. Sometimes I will hear people say, well, the difficulty is getting the ladder line into, or the windowed line, or the ladder line, into my station. I'm told that I can't get it anywhere near metal. Could you address that?
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm glad you mentioned it, because that is perhaps another downside of window line or open wire line. The nice thing about coax is, by its nature, all of the fields are within the coax if it's operated properly. That means you can run it in a pipe, you can coil it up, you can bury some kinds of it, you can run it through any kind of building materials, and it won't know about its environment. Not true with the balanced, unshielded lines, such as window line or ladder or open wire line. The reason is that the fields actually extend out from the window line. Typically, the majority of the fields are within 3 times the separation of the two conductors.
Ah.
So if you have conductors that are, like with window line, typically 3/4 of an inch apart or something like that, that means, let's see, about 2 inches or so on any side,
mm-hmm.
You need to keep that clear. If it goes along something lossy, particularly dirt, if you lay it on the ground,
mm-hmm.
as often happens, particularly in field day or something, the loss is extremely high. We've measured up to 10 or 20 dB of loss.
Ooh, wow.
So all of a sudden your low loss thing turns into an attenuator. The good news is it's easy to tune, but the bad news is it doesn't get much signal out the other end. So you have to be careful about that. You can't roll it up or it won't operate like window line. Now, metal is a little bit of a different story. What metal will do is actually change the impedance of the line, but it won't necessarily result in significant loss. But if you run it up against, staple it to a tree or something, the wood can be lossy. If you run it through some kinds of building materials, it can be lossy. So it can mm-hmm. be a problem. The other thing is, within that 2 or 3 times the spacing of the wire area, if you picture kind of a tube about that size,
mm-hmm.
if you have other signals in that area, they will be picked up by the window line and vice versa.
Oh.
So while we think of a transmission line as something that you just put signals in one end and they come out the other end, that's only true if you don't interrupt the process by putting something in the field within it. And the same thing would happen with coax if you inserted a signal within the coax, or if you don't properly terminate the coax and you have common mode current on the outside of the shield, as often mm-hmm. happens. For example, if you don't use a balun at your dipole, coax will do the same thing. So it's not a dramatic negative in comparison to most coax installations, but it is something you have to be aware of. So what some people do is, if their tuner is near an outside wall, a short length of coax from the tuner to a balun that's outside will allow the coax to run in the unfriendly environment, and then the transition to the window line or open wire line can happen outside.
Mm-hmm.
And the only problem with that is, of course, then you have the mismatched coax in between. But
yes.
if it's 8 or 10 feet, chances are the loss is not going to be that much as compared to 100 feet of going all the way to the antenna. So that's often a reasonable compromise, is to do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
You can even make shielded balanced line by using a pair of coax cables and hooking the shields together at both ends.
I've seen that done, yes.
And that can be run through unfriendly regions. I used that to bring my rhombic terminations through a sills sitting on my foundation at one point,
mm-hmm.
by drilling holes that the coax fit through, and I soldered the window line on both sides, and that worked just fine. So that's another thing you can do. So you can you don't have to fight your way through with the window line all the way into the house. But if you do, make sure it's not someplace where you'll have a problem. What I did with mine is my shack was in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
I had exposed floor joists for the first floor right above it. And I just use standoff insulators about 3 inches long to support the window line going along a floor joist.
Okay, we have a question submitted from a podcast listener. This gentleman is Augustus, AC9FB, and he's asking, can you tell me how 100 watts output became the standard for modern transceivers?
Okay, that's an interesting question, and one that I hadn't encountered before, because I've sort of always assumed 100 watts too as the standard. That's what all the transceivers are. Well, why is that? Well, I think that the reason for that is the very first single sideband transceiver that became popular was the Collins KWM1 from 1957, and a bit later, even more popular, the KWM2, which covered 80 through 10 meters, the ham bands at that time, not all the bands we have today. It used a pair of 6146 beam power tubes as final amplifiers.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, power ratings were provided as DC input power, and these were rated for 175 watts PEP input on single sideband, with 100 watts PEP output being a conservative output rating for CW and SSB. Now, what happened is everybody else tried to get on the bandwagon and compete with Collins. And, of course, to compete, you had to make something look the same, work the same, and cost less.
Yes.
And Heathkit was the first people that really came out in a big way with their SB100 and then follow-on units, multiple series of transceivers. They looked a lot like Collins KWM2s. They were about the same size.
Mm-hmm.
They had the same output tubes. And, of course, they also ran 100 watts output. So that became kind of follow the leader. Everybody had to do what Collins did. And there were a few other companies that did slightly different things. Drake always kind of saw their own little, listened to their own drummer a little bit, and they had different kinds of tubes and a little more power. But other people, by and large, stuck with 100 watts output. And those tubes, by the way, go back before single sideband. I have a pair of 6146s in my Johnson Viking 2 AM CW transmitter, which weighs about four times as much as the KWM2 and puts out about 100 watts also. There was a move, when did it really start? Around, let's say, late 70s, early 80s, to solid-state equipment. At first, they still had the 6146s as final amplifiers, mm-hmm. but eventually we came to have solid-state finals. And, of course, to be able to sell a transceiver, it had to be just as good as the vacuum tube ones you were trying to replace.
Yes.
So their target was also 100 watts, and all of a sudden we had a 100-watt solid-state transceiver, so that's kind of continued to
mm-hmm.
this day. Now, there have been exceptions. Hallicrafters had transceivers with up to, I think, 1,000 watts.
Yes, they did. That's right.
Maybe power input, but some big transceivers.
Yeah.
And other people did as well, and some people had mobile rigs at the 50-watt level in the tube days, perhaps with one 6146 or some kind of TV sweep tube in the output. So there were a number of other things. It isn't the only power level you'll find. But primarily, that's what people do, is 100-watt HF transceivers, not counting the ones that are 5 or 10 watts and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But most people that get other power levels do so outside of the transceiver with an amplifier nowadays.
So it's a matter of almost tradition.
I think it's tradition and competition. I think competition was the big driver. Trying
yes.
to make something that looked like person on the top of the heap, which was the Collins KWM2 at that time. And that rig was in production for many years and largely supported by the Air Force, which used them in large numbers. I think most SAC, Strategic Air Command aircraft, had Collins KWM2 or equivalent. They had some military, similar radios
mm-hmm.
for the military, but they used a lot of that equipment, and I think that made it very
yes.
pop. Made a lot of them ended up being produced, and they've been around for a long time and still are very much used on the air.
Okay.
It's also a nice number. 100 watts is a nice number. You can remember that number. If it were 87, it would be a little harder, you know.
Well, thank you, Joel.
My
another
pleasure.
Another excellent podcast.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure, Steve.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.